The Great Entrepreneurial Awakening. Back in Boston, meanwhile, there is meaning and exciting purpose wherever you look. When I visited in the spring of 2015, I found a city in the grip of a collective mania, an enthusiasm for innovation that I can only compare to a religious revival, to the kind of crowd passion that would periodically sweep through New England back in the days when the purpose of Harvard was to produce clergymen, not startups. The frenzy manifests itself in countless ways. The last mayor of Boston was mourned on his passing as a man who believed in innovation, who brought innovation to Boston. The state's Innovation Institute issues annual reports on the Massachusetts innovation economy. As innovation economies go, they brag, this one is the largest in the U.S. when measured as a percent of employment. And of course, there are publications that cover this thrumming beehive of novelty. BostInno, a startup website dedicated to boosting startups, and Beta Boston, which is a project of the more established but still super enthusiastic Boston Globe. Fall River is pocked with empty mills, but the streets of Boston are dotted with facilities intended to make entrepreneurship easy and convenient. In my brief time there, I toured innovation center after innovation center, each one featuring brightly colored furniture, open workspaces, inspiring quotations about inventiveness, ping-pong tables and Guitar Hero sets and other instruments of break-time levity, not one of which I ever saw actually being used, and walls that were covered with high-gloss paint meant to be written upon with dry-erase markers. In addition to these many designated centers of business creativity, I discovered that Boston boasts a full-blown innovation district, a disused industrial neighborhood that has actually been zoned creative, a projection of the post-industrial blue state ideal onto the urban grid itself. The heart of the neighborhood is a building called District Hall, Boston's new home for innovation, which appeared to me to be a glorified multi-purpose room enclosed in a sharply angular facade and sharing a roof with a restaurant that offers inventive cuisine for innovative people. The Wi-Fi was free. The screens hung here and there displayed still more famous quotations about inventiveness, and of course the walls were writable, but otherwise it was not much different from an ordinary public library, aside from not having anything to read, that is. This was my introduction to the innovation infrastructure of the city, much of it built up by entrepreneurs shrewdly angling to grab a piece of the entrepreneur craze. There are co-working spaces like Work Bar and WeWork, shared offices for startups that can't afford the real thing. There are startup incubators and startup accelerators which aim to ease the innovator's eternal struggle with an uncaring public. The Startup Institute, for example, and the famous Mass Challenge, the world's largest startup accelerator, which runs an annual competition for new companies and hands out prizes at the end. The keystone of the InnoStructure is the university. Indeed, some people in this city of universities have come to believe that the starting up of companies and the launching of professional careers is the very purpose of higher education. The one equals the other. It's the reason MIT has two associate deans for innovation rather than just one, and that its president writes op-eds instructing the nation about the right way to deliver innovation. It's the reason Northeastern University has a venture accelerator it calls IDEA, that Harvard has the famous Innovation Center, that Boston University's Business School has a Department of Strategy and Innovation, that its College of Engineering has a Product Innovation Center, and that one of its colleges offers a certificate in innovation and entrepreneurship. At Harvard, where I met innovation guru Clayton Christensen ambling across a parking lot, the dream of being the next Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates is almost palpable. As well as the usual incubators and accelerators, the school boasts a $100 million venture capital fund that is focused on commercializing the ideas of former students. One of this fund's press releases quotes a Harvard professor on how this heap of money advances the school's mission, which today, apparently, includes, quote, marshaling significant resources to help create thrilling companies. The fund holds campus events, too, and at the one I attended at a Harvard dormitory called Elliott House, an audience of undergraduates listened as a professor from a nearby university talked about his many patents in the medical and pharmaceutical fields. Sometimes the theology of the innovation cult is stated plainly. We know what makes an economy work, and it is university-driven innovation. The state's own Department of Housing and Economic Development says it flatly on its website. Quote, "The foundation of the Massachusetts economy is the innovative and entrepreneurial capability of its residents to transform existing technologies and industries and create new ones." This is the state's government speaking, remember. It continues. The pillars of this innovation economy are the state's universities and research institutions, the rich cluster of innovation-based companies, and the sophisticated angel, venture capital, and financial services communities that help fund and mentor the pipeline of entrepreneurs. At the heart are the skilled and creative people who choose to make Massachusetts their home. More typical, however, are tail-chasing proclamations like this one, which can be found on the website of the MIT Innovation Initiative. Quote, "The MIT Innovation Initiative is an institute-wide, multi-year agenda to transform the institute's innovation ecosystem internally, around the globe, and with its partners for accelerated impact well into the 21st century." This sounds distinctly like bullshit. But if MIT wants to think of itself in such a way, that's their business. The problem arises when we enshrine innovation as a public philosophy, when we look to it as the solution to our economic ills and understand it as the guide for how economies ought to parcel out rewards. To put it bluntly, it is not clear that cheering for innovation in the bombastic way we see in the blue states actually improves the economic well-being of average citizens. For example, the last 15 years have been a golden age of financial and software innovation, but they've been feeble in terms of GDP growth. In ideological terms, however, innovation definitely works as a way of excusing soaring inequality and explaining the exalted status of the rich. It's the best we've got. Triumph of the Innocrats. Massachusetts' identification with the Democratic Party is profound and well known. The home state of the Kennedy family, it has produced two other Democratic presidential nominees in recent decades, Governor Michael Dukakis and Senator John Kerry. And it was, as we know, the only state won by George McGovern in 1972. Mitt Romney, the Republican leader in 2012, also hailed from the Bay State, but Massachusetts was none too enthusiastic about his candidacy. When that year's results were in, Romney didn't carry a single county of the state he had once served as governor. Even when Massachusetts has had Republican governors, it hasn't really mattered. Not only do these lonesome GOPers tend to be just as dedicated as their rivals to the blue state model, but the mass legislature remains lopsidedly Democratic no matter what, capable of passing whatever it chooses over the governor's veto. In the time I was writing this book, for example, the state Senate included only 6 Republican members out of 40, a lopsided normal that is, among other things, an almost perfect mirror image of the Kansas State Senate. Politically speaking, the cult of the knowledge economy goes back a long way in Massachusetts. Many, if not all, of the state's leading politicians have done their part boosting for it over the years, celebrating startups and professing their admiration for the creative class. Among this honor roll of innovation Democrats, former Governor Deval Patrick, who presided over the Massachusetts government from 2007 to 2015, takes pride of place. He is typical of liberal class leaders. You might even say he's their most successful exemplar. Everyone seems to like him, even his opponents. He is a witty and affable public speaker as well as a man of competence, a highly educated technocrat who is comfortable in corporate surroundings. Thanks to his upbringing in a Chicago housing project, he also understands the plight of the poor, and perhaps best of all, he is an honest politician in a state accustomed to wide-open corruption. Patrick was also the first black governor of Massachusetts and in some ways an ideal Democrat for the era of Barack Obama, who, as it happens, is one of his closest political allies. "Our government is incredibly enlightened," said John Hawthorne, the head of the Mass Challenge Startup Incubator, in a 2010 TED Talk, in which he explained why he chose Massachusetts for his planned entrepreneurial utopia. "I would wager a bet," he continued, "that Deval Patrick could go head-to-head on an intelligence test with any other governor." Patrick's oft-told life story follows the classic Democratic trajectory. A young man with loads of intelligence but no money, Patrick was lifted from Nowheresville by an academic scholarship to a fancy prep school. A few years after that, he got into Harvard and, in exactly the manner of the Clinton and Obama stories, the doors to a previously unknown world swung open for him. He climbed effortlessly through the meritocracy. Law school was also Harvard, and after working for the NAACP for a number of years, Deval Patrick went to Washington and ran the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, an important job. In 1994, he won a $54 million settlement in a memorable discrimination suit against Denny's Restaurants. Among other things, the chain had once refused service to black members of the president's Secret Service unit. And shortly afterward, Patrick took up a case that had to do with the subprime real estate lender Long Beach Mortgage. The charge this time was discriminatory lending. Eventually, Patrick settled this case too, although for a less impressive sum. In the aughts, Deval Patrick became a corporate lawyer, and before long he took the customary next step for Democrats of a certain kind. He went to work for the very corporate outfit he had once sued. Taking a seat in 2004 on the board of the parent company of the subprime lender that was now calling itself AmeriQuest. Yes, AmeriQuest. In 2004, the company was the country's largest subprime lender and, we now know, a pioneer in the kinds of practices that, after being adopted by many others, came close to destroying the world's financial system. For AmeriQuest insiders, packaging up stated income loans and sending them down the Wall Street pipeline was a highly profitable business, an innovative business even. For everyone else on the planet, it was like chugging arsenic. Bankers profited, and the world paid. The world is still paying. Any politician associated with this sleazy outfit should have had his career terminated immediately and unconditionally. Patrick dodged that particular bullet, however. He was elected governor of Massachusetts in November of 2006, the year before the first tremors of the coming economic earthquake would be felt. The controversies arising from his service on AmeriQuest's board were easily contained. As governor, Patrick became a kind of missionary for the innovation cult. "The Massachusetts economy is an innovation economy," he liked to declare, and he made similar comments countless times, slightly varying the order of the optimistic keywords. "Innovation is a centerpiece of the Massachusetts economy," etc., etc. The governor opened innovation schools, a species of ramped-up charter school. He signed the Social Innovation Compact, which had something to do with meeting the private sector's need for skilled entry-level professional talent. In a 2009 speech called The Innovation Economy, Patrick elaborated the political theory of innovation in greater detail, telling an audience of corporate types in Silicon Valley about Massachusetts' high concentration of brain power and world-class universities, and how we in government are actively partnering with the private sector and the universities to strengthen our innovation industries. What did all of this InnoTalk mean? Well, much of the time, it was pure applesauce, standard-issue platitudes to be rolled out every time some pharmaceutical company opened an office building somewhere in the state. On other occasions, Patrick's favorite buzzword came with a gigantic price tag, like the $1 billion in subsidies and tax breaks that the governor authorized in 2008 to encourage pharmaceutical and biotech companies to do business in Massachusetts. Lesser achievements included the $1 million Patrick spent to provide assistance, mentoring, and advice to startups and innovation companies, and the other $1.5 million spent to support startups at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. On still other occasions, favoring Inno has meant bulldozing the people in its path. For instance, the taxi drivers whose livelihoods are being usurped by ride-sharing apps like Uber. When these workers staged a variety of protests in the Boston area, Patrick intervened decisively on the side of the distant software company. Apparently, convenience for the people who ride in taxis was more important than good pay for the people who drive those taxis. It probably didn't hurt that Uber had hired a former Patrick aide as a lobbyist, but the real point was, of course, innovation. Uber was the future, the taxi drivers were the past, and the path for Massachusetts was obvious. No surprise, then, that the first recipient of the Deval Patrick Commonwealth Innovation Award was none other than Deval Patrick. The prize was bestowed on him in 2014 by Mass Challenge's Hawthorne, joined by the CEO of Uber, Travis Kalanick, who showed up in order to add some entrepreneurial gravitas to the moment. I wanted to be here to thank the governor for his leadership, his vision around innovation, around technology, and creating that innovative spirit here in Massachusetts, Kalanick said on that solemn occasion. Eric Schmidt, the chairman of Google, was also on hand to salute Massachusetts for an explosion of startups. We need more entrepreneurs because they create jobs. They solve every known problem, he intoned. That was a bold claim to make for any social cohort, but John Hawthorne went even farther. Mass Challenge is an attempt to remind us and refocus as a community and a society on creating value, he declared. We designed it to help entrepreneurs win because entrepreneurs are the value creators of society. Now, this was not a political event, strictly speaking, but that last comment was most definitely a political statement, as blunt a justification of class hierarchy as anything I've heard this side of the Tea Party movement. 3 months after the prize ceremony, the Democrat Deval Patrick's second term as governor came to an end. A short while later, he won an even bigger prize, a job as a managing director of Bain Capital, the private equity firm founded by Mitt Romney and that had been so powerfully denounced by the Democrats during the 2012 election. Patrick spoke about the job like it was just another startup. It was a happy and timely coincidence that I was interested in building a business that Bain was also interested in building, he told the Wall Street Journal. Romney reportedly phoned him with congratulations. Entrepreneurs first. Another thing that Google's Eric Schmidt said on the occasion of the Deval Patrick Commonwealth Innovation Award was that if you want to solve the economic problems of the U.S., create more entrepreneurs. That sort of sums up the ideology in this corporate commonwealth. But how has such a doctrine become holy writ in a party dedicated to the welfare of the common man? And how has all this come to pass in the liberal state of Massachusetts? The answer is that I've got the wrong liberalism. The kind of liberalism that has dominated Massachusetts for the last few decades isn't the stuff of Franklin Roosevelt or the United Auto Workers. It's the Route 128 suburban professionals variety. Professional class liberals aren't really alarmed by oversized rewards for society's winners. On the contrary, this seems natural to them because they are society's winners. The liberalism of professionals just does not extend to matters of inequality. This is the area where soft hearts abruptly turn hard. While Massachusetts is a liberal place, the state that sent Elizabeth Warren to the Senate, even, equality issues do not necessarily go over smoothly here. The state's income tax, to mention a particularly egregious example, is a flat tax, with the same rate paid by rich and poor alike. When the Massachusetts legislature raised the minimum wage in 2014, it was only after a huge grassroots campaign made it clear that the issue would soon pass as a ballot initiative anyway. In 2012, the legislature enacted a three-strikes mandatory sentencing law, a full 20 years after violent crime peaked in America. And when the legislature limited collective bargaining rights for public employees in 2011, causing columnists across the country to compare Massachusetts to Scott Walker's Wisconsin, Governor Deval Patrick eventually signed on. It was something the state had to do in order to cut costs, people said. Innovation liberalism is a liberalism of the rich, to use the straightforward phrase of local labor leader Harris Grumman. This doctrine has no patience with the idea that everyone should share in society's wealth. What Massachusetts liberals pine for, by and large, is a more perfect meritocracy, a system where everyone gets an equal chance and the truly talented get to rise. Once that requirement is satisfied, once diversity has been achieved, and the brilliant people of all races and genders have been identified and credentialed, this species of liberal can't really conceive of any further grievance against the system. The demands of ordinary working-class people, Grumman says, are unpersuasive to them. Janitors, fast food servers, home care or child care providers, most of whom are women and people of color, they don't have college degrees, Grumman says. And if you don't have a college degree in Boston, brother, you've got no one to blame but yourself.